Right now, we're experiencing the largest refugee crisis in human history. According to the UN Human Rights Commission, more than 68 million people were displaced from their homes in 2017 alone. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With so many people displaced, it's hard to remember that each refugee is a human being with an individual story to tell. This hour, I'll talk with Syrian-born artist and architect Mohammed Hafez. He has found a unique way to share the stories of refugees through his exhibit Unpacked, Refugee Baggage. Then later in the hour, I'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Lowry about everyday environmental hazards that can threaten children's health. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Lowry about how everyday environmental hazards can threaten the health of children around our country. But first, millions of people around the world are refugees, people who've been forced to leave their homes behind to survive, people from many different countries fleeing conflict, famine, or other life-threatening pressures. And with so many people displaced and so much heated rhetoric surrounding the refugee crisis, it's hard to remember that each refugee is a human being with an individual story to tell. And my next guest, Syrian-born artist and architect Mohammed Hafez, has come up with a unique way to share the stories of refugees. His exhibit, Unpacked, Refugee Baggage, will be on display at the Christian Peterson Art Museum at Iowa State University starting today through October 19th. And Hafez will be speaking in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. He is with me on the line right now. Hello, Mohammed.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. Absolutely.
And before we really dive into the exhibit and what people will see and hear when they visit, I want to talk about your story. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Sure. I was born in Damascus, but grew up majority of my childhood in Saudi Arabia. And then we moved back in 1999 when my father decided to retire back to Damascus. So technically, I've only lived in Damascus for about 4 years. But that was very important time growing up as a teenager, trying to find who I was and my roots. And then I came to Iowa State to study architecture in 2003. And the story goes is that I got stuck here. I couldn't go back home.
And why in 2003? That's before what we think of as the Syrian refugee crisis. So was happening in 2003 that made it so that you were here as a student but couldn't leave?
So the travel ban, as we all know it today, existed back then, but it had a different name, so not a whole lot of people knew about it. It was called a program called NSEERS, National Security Entry Exit Registration System, that required 26 nationalities, 25 Muslim majority, to register with authorities and FBI every time they had to leave or come in the country or apply for visas. This made traveling abroad and leaving the United States very risky. Background checks that usually take 2 weeks to issue a student visa took me a year and a half. So I learned very quickly that as long as I'm attending school here, I'm fine. But if I think about going back home to visit family, I risk everything. I might not be able to make it back here. And the consequence of that is I got stuck here 8 years, not being able to go back. And like you said, this was well before the Syrian war, arguably some of the best times Syria has seen. And I just grew very homesick and I couldn't be with my family.
Yeah, what did that feel like? I mean, most of us have been college students away from home, but maybe an hour and a half away from home or 5 hours away from home. What did that feel like for you to be so far from home and know that you couldn't go?
It was very tough. I think we take so many things for granted. A lot of people expect to be home every Thanksgiving, every Christmas with their parents. And I was the student stuck here over break, not being able to go home, very homesick, very nostalgic. My parents would send photos over, and you see your parents aging, and you see things are happening, and you miss your siblings' weddings and so on. In the scheme of things, and so that was, you know, started me in my artistic career. I out of nostalgia, I started modeling.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because you studied to be an architect at Iowa State University, but this artistic side grew out of what you were feeling. And you said modeling, but you're talking about creating miniatures?
Yeah, they're in essence architectural models. I'm not trained as an artist. The tools at hand were architectural models. And architects throw away a lot of scrap materials from a bunch of model making. So I would collect that and I would repurpose it and put it together. And I would spend 15, 20 hours on a small piece. But eventually you end up with a very high detailed miniature form of a facade or a building that looks like it belongs to old Damascus or old Aleppo.
What was the first model you made?
It was a facade of old Damascus. And I remember, for those Iowa Staters, I remember vividly where I was sitting in the Armory building. Back then we had studios there in a corner desk. I think I started around 6 p.m. And the next thing I know, I looked over and it's 3 in the morning. I had lost track of time, but I finished a small 12 inches by 12 inches facade. And I enjoyed that thoroughly. And I didn't know what it was or why I did that. But of course, now I know it was therapy through art. It was a cathartic expression.
What did you do with those early models that you created?
Oh, I hold them close and dear. They don't leave my house. A lot of exhibits that I get, they ask for those, and it's very hard to let go of them. So they stay close to me.
Now, you were a student at Iowa State University. Where did you go from there? You said you were here for 8 years without being able to go home.
Right. I graduated and I went to the East Coast to work for Picard Chilton. The fantastic partners of the firm also graduated from Iowa State. And I started working for them. It was through the firm that I went on a business trip to Lebanon and then to Damascus for the first time in 2011, right before the war and everything worsening.
Yeah, what was it like when you went in 2011? Could you feel the tension rising?
Absolutely. Of course, I had been tracking the Arab Spring and all of that from afar. And you get so nostalgic, you get, you know, so homesick that you come back and you're seeing everything in a different perspective and a different lens. And so I walked around old Damascus, recorded day-to-day life. And people would look at me crazy. Like, what are you doing? This is day-to-day. I would record call to prayers, people running in the streets, merchants, kids, taxi, you know, little conversations I would have with the cab driver. And he goes, you know, we're barely making it on 100 liras today. Well, today, 10,000 liras is barely enough because of, you know, the economy.
Right. Did you have a sense at that point that you were recording a way of life that may not last?
You know what? I had a inner feeling. I had a really weird inside feeling that said, capture this, you might not be back anytime soon. Given everything that happened in the region, given the everything that had started in the country, I sensed something would happen, and I hoped to God that it would not be true, but sadly that wasn't the case.
Where is your family today?
We are all over. We're 4 siblings and 2 parents. My brother's in Dubai, my sister's in Chicago, and my youngest sister is now a refugee in Sweden. And my parents kind of oscillate between all of us. But to tie back to your story, you know, to your first question, the 4 siblings and the 2 parents of us have not been under a single roof since 2004. And that's primarily because of visa restrictions. Either they cannot come to the United States because we won't issue them a visiting visa, or I cannot go to Europe because Europe will look at me as an intending refugee, and so on, or the Gulf countries and so on.
Well, and when you talk about your sister being a refugee, we've all seen the news footage, the images of people boarding boats to cross the Mediterranean, a last-ditch effort to get to safety. And that's your sister's story, right?
It is. It is. And it was the last thing that we would ever imagine. You know, they had a very comfortable life. My brother-in-law is also an architect and an extremely successful businessman back home. And I was on a business trip in Italy in 2014, and he called me out of the blue, and he said, "Mohammed, I made it to Sweden." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, life hit a wall over there in Syria. Things got in a little bit too bad, and I had to find a better life for me and your sister." So I took one of those dinghies across the Mediterranean at night, and I made it to Sweden. And I flew immediately to Sweden and met him, and I was the first family member. And I think he had just arrived the night before, so it was very fresh. And that's what, you know, turned my entire artistic practice upside down. That's what made it now really, really personal.
Yeah. What went through you when he told you that? I mean, we've seen so many people lose their lives in that journey. What was your feeling?
It's the last time I had seen him, it was in 2011 in his comfortable setting. And life goes by so fast. You know, we would talk here and there, but to see your own family member in a refugee camp literally the next time is something I don't think we're prepared for. We take so much for granted. And the details of that trip, that risky trip that he had to endure, it was really unbelievable. The things that he went through, he got chased on borders, shot at, slept in the wilderness. There are details that I can't even tell you, but it was not easy.
And they made it to Sweden. What is their status now?
Well, they are now legal residents of Sweden. Of course, most of us sometimes latch on the before, the war aspect, the hardships. But what I try to focus on is what are the refugees doing today? And as it turns out, my brother-in-law happens to be resettled in one of the areas that have very few architects. He is doing fantastic as an architect. He just established his firm. He just bought a house. And his wife and their kids, they are now living and contributing to the host society that welcomed them.
We're going to take a short break. When we get back, we will talk about the exhibit Unpacked Refugee Baggage, which is part of the vision of Mohammed Hafez. He is a Syrian-born artist and architect educated at Iowa State University. And the exhibit will be on display at the Christian Peterson Art Museum at Iowa State starting today through October 19th. He'll also be speaking in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. That lecture is open to the public. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up later this hour, I'll talk with Dr. Jennifer Lowry. She's traveling to Iowa to talk about everyday environmental hazards that can threaten the health of children. She'll be at the University of Northern Iowa this week. With me right now is Mohammed Hafez. He is a Syrian-born artist and architect, and he is one of the people behind a new exhibit called Unpacked, Refugee Baggage. This exhibit will be on display at the Christian Peterson Art Museum at Iowa State University through October 19th, and Hafez will be speaking in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University tomorrow evening at 8 p.m. That lecture is open to the public. And Mohammed, let's talk about this exhibit. It's both a visual exhibit and an audio exhibit. But when I walk into the room, what will I see?
Well, I'm hoping to transport you to a different city outside of Iowa. You will hear sounds from different parts of the world, particularly from the Middle East. And you will see a lot of suitcases that are hung off the wall with kind of miniature dioramas modeled inside them. Next to each suitcase, there will be a headset. And when you put the headset, you will hear a refugee speak back to you in English, and there's no barrier between you and them. It's just both of you for 90 seconds, giving you a glimpse of what they went through and a glimpse of what they're doing today. And further, if you were to learn more about the family, there's a placard by the suitcase that tells you a little bit more.
Let's get a taste for what the exhibit is like. You have a collaborator named Ahmed Badr, and why don't we listen to a little bit of his story? He is the one who put together the audio section of the whole exhibit. He interviewed many different refugees, including you and your family's story. But let's hear a little bit from Ahmed. We'll hear his voice and his mother telling their story. They're from Iraq, and in 2006, their home was bombed by militia troops. They migrated to Syria, but Ahmed's parents, both civil engineers, couldn't find work. They applied for refugee status and eventually were resettled in South Dakota.
I wasn't home. It was the first time I spent away from home. And I remember Baba came to pick me up the day after. Baba is the Arabic word for father. And I could immediately sense something was wrong. You know when your parents, there's something
wrong.
And on the way back, he said, Ahmed, he kind of took like one of those deep parental breaths. And he said, Ahmed, our house was bombed last night. And I didn't know what he was talking about.
Yeah, it's like a dream.
It was a dream, yeah.
Nightmare.
Yeah, a nightmare, yeah. And I remember going back and seeing the chaos and the destruction. As someone who was there, experienced it, can you describe how it was for me?
I remember we were walking in the garden, just fixing something. I don't remember exactly. Before sunset, we get back inside our home. Electricity was down, so I don't know what's happened. It's dark and dust everywhere, and I just hear my daughter crying, and I can't see her, I just hear her crying. And your dad said maybe it is the gas cylinder exploded. The neighbor, all of them, they came and they said, we saw the missile. Then when the light comes, we saw what happened. There is a hole on the restroom wall. That's the first hole. And then goes to the kitchen, and all the wall was
destroyed.
Yeah. And this was a horrible.
So that's just a little bit of the Badr family's story. And Mohammed, tell me, when you're listening to that story, you'll be looking at a suitcase and a diorama that you have created. What will you see when you're listening to that story?
You're basically seeing their home. We asked Ahmed's mother to draw us a floor plan of their house and the missile projection through the house. And so you will see the restroom that she was describing, and you will see a living room, and you'll see the kitchen. And basically that missile came in and turned 90 degrees and came out and threw three gas canisters. Back home, our propane gas canisters are very large, and that's what we use for cooking. And it's just by, the grace of God that the Badr family had decided 2 days before to empty them. A missile going through one of full gas canister is enough to blow up the entire neighborhood. And they were, by the grace of God, were saved.
When you created these pieces of art that accompany the display, what was your process?
I sat into these interviews and I listened to their stories, and I started asking questions, architectural questions, about what was your favorite room in the house? What did you pack with you? What did you take with you? If somebody started describing the cup of coffee or cup of tea they left right before, I took notes. And so I put myself in the shoes of this family. I invested in learning more about their story. And it was very, very emotional for me. Up to till that point, I had built sculptures that told my story and my family. And I had never, ever built something that told someone else's story to the world. And it was very stressful to take on such responsibility, but it was also very fulfilling to see their reaction once they've seen it done.
Yeah, what was that like? Did you get to show everyone what you made?
Oh, absolutely. They had no clue what I was working on for months. We just sat down for the interview, and I showed up with an invitation to an exhibit, and they showed, and they came, and they saw their photos on the wall, and they saw their stories told on these suitcases, and they saw part of their history modeled in a suitcase. Some of these suitcases are, we got them from them, actually, and others were donated to us, and the emotions were all over. It was very, very emotional, and a lot of hugs, a lot of, you know, thank you. We could never, you know, tell our stories, or people never take the time to ask us about our stories because they're so busy with work and so on. And, you know, I am a softie, and they, you know, they hug me with tears and I tear up and so on.
Let's listen to another one of the, just a segment from one of the interviews that accompanies the display. This is the voice of, I believe her name is Fereshta.
Yes.
She's from Afghanistan, but she was raised in Iran. And at the age of 22, she founded a secret elementary school for Afghan children in Tehran. She now lives and teaches Farsi in Connecticut at the University of New Haven. She's also attending nursing school. Here's a little of her story.
Every year, new people come to the Iran. Every year, they have new refugees.
Mm-hmm.
People who are like my parents were there for a long time. They had documentation.
Yeah.
And we were allowed to go to school from first grade to high school.
Okay.
But the people who are just coming, their kids weren't allowed to go to school because there is no documentation for them.
And that's why you started your
secret
school. Yes.
I thought it would be better to have a school and help them.
What did it look like?
It was a secret basement, maybe 1,000 feet. And then we had like a lot of students, 150 students during the morning and 150 during the afternoon. All came to these 5 little classes, and always we lived under stress. We all the time scared. When I was at home, my mother checked the doors. I don't want police came and looking for you. Because every month they send us a letter. You have to close the school. You have to close the school. But when I see the face of my students, I cannot do that. I still remember they closed the school for a week. And all of my students are fasting and pray to God when they can open the school.
Yeah.
I went with one of my friends during the night. It was locked. We broke the lock and said, okay, you can all come to school tomorrow. We just tell the student, please be quiet. No one should know you are here. Just come and sit. We had the class for 2 months. Then after 2 months, again, police came and find out about our school.
Again, just a little bit of Fereshta's story about the secret school that she founded for Afghan children in Tehran. And what do we see, Mohammed, when we're listening to Fereshta's story? What does her suitcase hold?
So I took a stab at modeling that secret underground school that she was describing to me. And the suitcase of Fereshta is actually her mother's suitcase. And we modeled the entire scene inside it. And you could see sort of a simplistic way of furnishing, kind of discreet way with carpets and pillows and a little blackboard tucked to the side.
When people go and visit your exhibit, what are you hoping that they'll learn from the experience of hearing all of these stories and in seeing the miniature worlds that you've created?
As you said, refugees are humans like us with goals and aspirations and hopes and dreams. And I hope that people walk away realizing the large common denominator between all of us, none of us are single liners. None of us can be boiled down to just a label, to just a refugee label. There is more to us. We're not trying to romanticize the label by any means, but we're also encouraging people with all this rhetoric in the media to investigate for themselves and to invest in meaningful conversations. Because I also understand the unknown. I understand the fear of the unknown. And all it takes is a cup of coffee and you know, some conversations. And before you know it, that refugee family is not that different from your family.
You said you're not trying to romanticize these families or these refugees. What do you think the danger is there?
The danger, people can go either both extremes. What we have today is a harsh pushback against immigrants and refugees, and that's one extreme. And the other extreme is saying, well, you know, it's overly romanticizing a large population that are millions of people. There's something illogical of thinking that millions of people and different nations and tribes would have a certain character. It does not justify that we treat everybody with a broad brushstroke or come up with travel bans and laws that just ban you from moving just because your passport color is green or Syrian or so on. And so the danger is you normalize hate. That's the danger. That's not good.
And when you talk about romanticizing, thinking about all refugees in a positive light, what's the danger there?
What's the danger? Say that again.
Well, if you, you're concerned that you don't want to romanticize the lives of these individuals, and I mean, you've profiled some pretty extraordinary people. What would be the danger that you're trying to avoid in making sure we don't think, oh, all refugees are these fantastic, amazing people?
Absolutely, because they're people, and people are different, and people are different from one another. Being a refugee does not mean they're a security risk, but that doesn't mean they're also going to be the CEO of a Fortune 500. They're humans. We have to invest in conversations between us to see what they're aspiring to and how can they benefit this host society. I can tell you and assure you that almost everybody we spoke to had high aspirations and goals of making a living and a future for them and their kids. And that's one large common denominator among all of us here.
This exhibit will be at Iowa State through October 19th. What does it mean to you to have this exhibit on display at your alma mater at Iowa State, where you came for an education and were stuck also unable to go home for so long?
I'm still stuck, by the way. It's an honor and a privilege, of course, no question. But it also, it's a very complicated feeling how quick 10 years go by. It's a bittersweet feeling because I walk around the campus today and I'm nostalgic and I say, well, maybe a couple of moments ago I was just here at this desk. And it's bittersweet not because I've gotten older or anything, but because of what had happened through these 10 years. So, but it highlights the responsibility that artists have on their shoulders to draw common bridges and not walls between cultures, and the responsibility of artists to humanize and to document the history they're living in.
We talked earlier about how the refugee crisis in Syria, the war in Syria, has affected your family. You are scattered. You have not all been under one roof in 14 years. I'm curious, as a professional man from Syria, working and living in the United States, how has the heated rhetoric over refugees in the United States, how has that changed your life?
It changed it a lot. It actually gives me a lot of momentum to keep doing what I'm doing, to take time off from work, from my profession, to do this artwork and to humanize and to tell our story. Because, quite frankly, I am I say this with high pride, that I was raised in the Midwest, that all of my kind of hardworking manners and all of the skills that I was taught were from the Midwest. And I take that with high pride, the values that I was taught here. So with that said, I can relate to the East and the West inside me. And I can understand the fear that someone might have against people they don't know or have never interacted with, or if you're just basing your perception on what you see on the media or what you hear politicians say. And so that puts a big responsibility on me to draw the bridges between both realities that I live. They don't contradict each other. They don't have to be. Being an immigrant Syrian Muslim does not contradict being a professional, successful architect living and working and giving back to the United States. And you apply that logic to refugees and immigrants all over the United States. This is the American dream, and I hope we stay true to it.
Mohammed, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Mohammed Havez, he is an architect and an artist, Syrian-born, educated at Iowa State University as well as other places. And his exhibit, Unpacked Refugee Baggage, will be on display at the Christian Peterson Art Museum at Iowa State University through October 19th. It's both a visual exhibit and an audio exhibit where you'll get to hear the stories of refugees. He'll be speaking in the sunroom of the Memorial Union at Iowa State University tomorrow evening at 8. The lecture is open to the public. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. As parents, we work hard to protect our children from danger, but many of the dangers that might threaten the health of our children are hard to see. Dr. Jennifer Lowry is director for the Division of Pediatric Pharmacology and Toxicology and Therapeutic Innovation at Children's Mercy in Kansas City, and she's traveling to Iowa to share her concerns about environmental hazards that can harm the health of children. She'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the Schindler Education Center at the University of Northern Iowa. Her talk is titled Protecting Children's Health, Where They Live, Learn, and Play, and she is with me on the line now. Hello, Dr. Lowry.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And one of the things that you want people to understand, first and foremost, and I think it's a good place to start our conversation, is that children are not small adults. Why is that important to think about?
I think it's important because we tend to forget that, right? The children that we have or have these exposures, and we tend to give them, or at least think that they can have same doses and same medicines and same foods, but they are very different. I mean, I think it's important to remember that when we're born, we're not born done, right? We don't talk and we don't walk and we don't have concrete and abstract thinking even going on at that point. Over time and mostly in the first 5 years of our lives is when most of our organs and connections are being made, and anything that can interfere with that can have lifelong implications.
So when you're talking about exposures, I mean, let's talk about the kinds of environmental hazards you're concerned about. You study environmental toxicology. What kinds of things do children and all of us come into contact with that worry you?
Well, it's the whole gamut. So clearly it's what we feel, so what we touch. Again, children's skin is not done. And so any chemicals that are put onto their skin is going to get into them. It's definitely what we breathe. So that environment that in our homes or in our schools or even outside can get into their lungs and get into their blood and then go to different organs. And then clearly what we eat can cause harm just because of the food that we have, but then also everything that comes with that food, from what is put on it intentionally or what is put into it unintentionally.
What kinds of patterns do you feel like we're seeing when you look at children's health in the United States today that shows that our kids are coming into contact with harmful chemicals in their environment?
Sure. Sure. So I think that we all see obesity rates going up. That is largely, again, because of the choices that we make in regard to the foods that we choose to eat. But even healthy foods can have what we call obesogens or endocrine disruptors in them from the plastics that they come in contact with or the things that get incorporated into the food when it's grown can actually cause harm to the hormones in a child's system to then cause obesity. We also have our increases in ADHD and behavioral problems. Some of that obviously is again choices in families and how families are raised, but also in, you know, we have continue to have lead poisoning in the world. We have, you know, mercury in our air. We have other chemicals that can cause harm and lead to behavioral problems and neurotoxicity in kids. So those are two big ones, I think, that we're seeing now.
You mentioned lead poisoning, and that's something that we have been talking about for a long time. Lead poisoning, exposure to secondhand smoke is another one, you know, carcinogens. That these are things that I hope everyone understands are dangers and are bad. Do you feel like we're doing enough on those fronts, things that there have been, you know, big multi-million dollar campaigns against?
Unfortunately, no, we are not. Lead has a very interesting history in that we knew that lead was a poison and caused harm to children and adults over 150 years ago. Yet it wasn't until the late 1970s when lead was removed from paint and from gasoline. And what we're finding now is we still have those aftermaths. What we do is we wait until a child is poisoned and we get their lead levels at 1 or 2 years of age, and then we're reactive. We go back to the home after the child has already been exposed or poisoned, and then we do something. When really what we need to do is have primary prevention, where we have the conversation before the child gets exposed, and we do something to prevent that child, because as we know, lead can cause significant and irreversible damage to the cells it comes in contact with. There are ways to overcome those effects, but it would be awesome if we didn't have those children exposed in the first place.
Let's go beyond those exposures that, again, I mean, I guess you don't hear people arguing and saying, oh, no, lead's fine. and secondhand smoke, that's fine. I mean, the other kinds of exposures that you were talking about with, you know, possible endocrine disruptors in plastics, that kind of thing, those things are very much in debate. Those are things that people will argue about. If you're looking for good scientific-based information on these things, where can you turn? Because there's a lot of chatter out there about different things, and it's hard to know what to believe.
Well, that is true. I mean, the debate is happening. So the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, they actually have a report that is published every couple of years, and it's called the Exposure Report. And if you were to go to the CDC and look at that, you would find that we have so much in us just from just normal contact that you don't think. So we could talk about phthalates and bisphenol A, or just the bisphenols, because we have taken bisphenol A out of many products. But if you like plastic, you have to make plastic. And plastic's not natural, so it's synthetic. It's chemicals that make it plastic. And those get in us, and we have high levels of phthalates and bisphenols in our bodies, and children actually have them in higher levels than adults do. You know, just thinking about, you know, the bottles that we give our children and the sippy cups and the toys that they chew on. Those things that we take for granted get in our bodies, and they mimic hormones and can cause problems early on in life and then obviously later. I think there's this misconception that just because it's out there on the market and we are able to purchase it, that clearly somebody has looked at it to know that it's safe. And that is not how it works. The Environmental Protection Agency does not have the same regulatory authority that the Food and Drug Administration does. So where our drugs are safer, the chemicals that are out there in the environment can be put out there, and EPA can't do anything about it until after harm has already been done.
So as a parent, we all have all of these fears that we're dealing with on a daily basis, and we still have to raise our kids in the world in which we live. What kinds of common sense steps do you feel that parents should be taking to limit the harm that their children may be experiencing from toxins in the environment?
That's a great question, and it can be really hard, but there are clearly things that parents can do and should not be, you know, freaking out as they're listening to me. First and foremost, we need to use things in the way that they were intended. So plastics are not supposed to be heated up, so we should not put them in the microwave, and we should not heat them in boiling water, and we can't do that. And so, put them in the dishwasher. If you look at a plastic container, and over time you see that it's starting either to get harder or it's starting to kind of get frayed and kind of scratchy, that's because we're changing the integrity of the plastic, which means when you heat it up and cool it off and heat it up again, those plastics will come out. So number one, use things the way that they were intended to be used. Second of all, I think just giving children a very nutritious but varied diet is important. There's a lot of, recent news about, metals and chemicals in our food, and unfortunately that is true. Whether you buy organic or not, there are still going to be chemicals or metals in them. But giving them children a variety of foods, of fruits and vegetables and whole grains, but not sticking to just one because they like it, but actually giving them a variety will decrease overall the amount of contaminants that we give our children. And not putting pesticides out. There are natural ways, integrated pest management, so that you don't have those chemicals commonly in contact with children. But then also the way that we treat our homes so that it doesn't cause those pests to be there can decrease those exposures.
So you're talking about killing insects in the home and things like that.
Correct.
And you said treating our homes so that the insects or the pests aren't there, because sometimes the pests can also cause danger to the family or create an unhealthy environment. So when you talk about integrated pest management, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about looking at the whole home, first of all. So, if there are ways for spiders and rodents and cockroaches to get into your home, largely it's because there's a hole there, right? So let's find out where the hole is. Or if there's the part of the home that the wood, is not stable, is that because of water issues? Let's take care of the water issue and then fix the problem. Clearly not putting food out and leaving it out is important. If you do see those pests, though, there are ways to, especially like spiders, you put double-sided tape out instead of, putting your borax or whatever out there. There are ways to the little roach baits and those kind of things. So we're not actually spraying chemicals everywhere. We're not going to have the fumigator come in, but there are ways to put targeted traps and stuff out there so that we can minimize those pests.
You've also written a great deal recently. You were talking about how the Environmental Protection Agency doesn't have the same kind of power to, control things that go into the environment as maybe the FDA does. But also you've written a great deal about concerns about the Environmental Protection Agency at this point in time, in this political climate, under this administration. Do you feel like this is an issue that is being ignored willfully at the moment?
Well, I'm clearly not from Iowa, so I don't know the specifics of how Iowa is addressing environmental concerns. On a national level, I think that we are going backwards in how we are protecting ourselves and the environment from ourselves, essentially. I think that the pollution is going to be on the rise with the current administration, and I'm very concerned about it, especially as regard to climate change, which I know is happening, and it will cause harm to us and our children and for generations.
Outside the home, we talked about what parents should do if they're concerned about this inside the home. Outside the home, on a bigger level, individuals who are concerned about this and the danger to children in our environment, but really the dangers to everyone. What do you think people can and should be doing to make a change?
Well, unfortunately, it's hard to make that on the individual level. Obviously, we can control what we have. We put in our yards and, on our plants and what is around us immediately. But even when we're talking, especially with agriculture, which is huge in Missouri and in Iowa, where, I've had patients who have come to see me because of pesticide exposure from drift. So when the pesticides are sprayed, and there are clearly rules to how it needs to be sprayed, but you can still get pesticide from the wind, drifting over and getting on people. And so that's a larger issue. And so you have to take that out of the individual and take it to the community, and sometimes even larger, to from the community to the city to the state and then to the national level. But unless parents and other caregivers speak out and talk about what they like and what they don't like about them, things are not going to change. And of course, we have an election coming up. So, but I don't want this to make it totally political. But I think that this is important in that we have to do it together, because air does not stay in one place. Air travels, around the world, and so the choices that we make here can greatly impact the population around us and even farther away.
Dr. Lowry, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jennifer Lowry, she's director for the Division of Pediatric Pharmacology, Toxicology, and Therapeutic Innovation at Children's Mercy in Kansas City. She's traveling to Iowa to share her concerns about environmental hazards that can harm the health of children. And she'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. at the Schindler Education Center at the University of Northern Iowa. Her talk is called Protecting Children's Health, Where They Live, Learn, and Play. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We'll be right back.